This is another Australian Baby Boomer podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Australian Baby Boomer podcast. Today's guest is Martin. Martin will be interviewing some of the people in this series in future episodes. The Australian Baby Boomer podcast series taps into ideas and stories that come from life experience, and a perspective that can only be gained from a point in life where most of life has already been lived. It is often a time of reflection, reassessment, and renewed identity. In today's episode, Martin speaks to these matters and tells his personal story of life and change in the third age. He begins by telling us a little bit about himself.
My name's Martin and I'm born again Australian, I suppose you could call me. I've been in Australia since 1966 and I was born overseas. And I find that when people say, where is your place? And that's a very Australian question. I'm certain that it's now Australia, it has been for a while. There was a period not long ago when I realised that I was in Perth longer than I'd been anywhere. And that was quite a shock to the system. Because, and in fact, I've been in this house longer than I've been anywhere in this town. I'm not a Sudanese person. I was born there. But my brother certainly believes he is. And I think it was for me because I was only there for 7 years and then I moved and I was all over the place for another 8 years before I came to Australia. And Australia was my home very quickly. And it makes perfect sense. I don't have any yearning to be anywhere else. But the best 7 years of my childhood were in another country altogether. And that was brilliant, a brilliant childhood. But came to Australia, finished my high school in Sydney, and ever since I've been an adult, whatever that is, I've lived and worked in Sydney and then Wollongong and then Melbourne and then Perth. And since I came to Perth, I really haven't moved. And that's been a long time now. 86, I think. 83 it was that I came to Perth.
What was it about Nigeria and your time there that made that such a brilliant childhood?
The freedom. Also, our family left some fairly difficult circumstances and it was a relief to be somewhere else. And as a child, it was very different to what it would have been like for my parents, I'm pretty certain. But as a child, it was just wonderful. I was unrestrained. I could do what I like. I was riding a bike. It was always hot. I had friends and immense freedom. And no one seemed to worry about this. I was a stranger in a strange land, and no one seemed to worry at all where I was, which is brilliant. I mean, you couldn't do that now. So I learned a lot about myself, and I had a lot of fun. And looking back, in retrospect, it's definitely the most pivotal 7 years of my life. I think it actually helped set me up, because it also got me through boarding school in England, which I did not like, which was part of that 7 years. And I was coming back from boarding school to Nigeria, and the contrast was astounding. And then I ended up coming to Australia to finish my schooling in Sydney. And that again was different and much more settling for me, much easier for me to be in Sydney than I was in England. The weather was better, the people were more friendly. It was just much different. So, yeah, and so that was an interesting beginning and just rushing over the middle bit. Married kids, living, in lots of different places. Made a career as an organisational consultant, which is one of those wanky job descriptions that have become popular in the last 10, 15 years, and been really fun to do, but I don't miss it. And I'm now working as a carer for the aged, which is completely different in some ways, very similar in others. And I'm not retired. I mean, technically, I finished my long-term career, but then I moved on. So I'm not sure I understand what retirement is, and I know that I couldn't live a life with nothing to do. To some extent, that 7 years I was telling you about, I didn't have any focus at all on the future. There's one pivotal thing that happened. I was in England, as I said, in boarding school for 3 years, and it was a shock to my system because England had a winter which was freezing and snow and ice and all those things that, as a tropical child, I just did not like. And being separated from my parents for that period. I was sort of caught between cultures. I love reading, I love writing. I love music, I was surrounded by it because my mother was a concert pianist, so I had music in the house all the time, but I am not at all focused on, I wasn't interested in career, I had no idea. My father being a doctor, my mother a pianist, my brother ended up in business, all those things I think were due to a sort of ambition and a focus. But for me, it was, I think that 7 years, that freedom was just freedom to be, to find out a bit more about who I was, which again sounds a bit wanky, but very useful, because I came into my adulthood just doing a job. I wasn't actually focused on the job as a career, and I didn't actually start doing that until I was probably in my late 30s. And that was when I was in a job, but then that job, I actually started choosing what I wanted to do in that job, and I started getting into consulting and working with groups and doing some psychology training. After my degree, I did some more ongoing study in psychology and organisational work, and that became very interesting, and I still do some of that. But that was, I really had no, I was never actually going to be a doctor or anything, but in fact, I can put my hand on my heart and say, because my father was a doctor, there's no way I was going to be a doctor. It was easier not to focus on any of that stuff. I just did a job. I got a job. Getting a job was easy back then. No, I couldn't get away with that now. But back then, you could just walk into off the street and get a job. But in fact, a large part of what I was doing was learning how to work with people, learning how to actually read people, learning how to listen, do all those things that you need to do if you're working with people in any sense. Because my study was, I was basically, for what it was worth, I was trained as a sociologist and an anthropologist. And to a large extent, the work I've done in organisations ever since has been anthropology, if you want to call it that.
Understanding people.
Understanding people and helping people to make sense of where they are, which is really what this process that I understand that this interview process is all about, is actually getting a sense of how I have made personal sense of where I am, and how that might help other people, or not, depending.
I guess it's, you know, to some extent there's something about community in there too, isn't there?
Yes.
It's about somehow making connections, and one of the biggest values of storytelling is to empathise.
And storytelling has been a big part of what I've done, unconsciously to a large extent initially, but now very definitely focused. And with the caring for the aged, I've been actually helping a number of my clients and other people write their family histories, so telling their own stories. And I did that with my mother for about 10 years. I mean, that was what set it off. For the last 10 years of her life, I was actually lucky enough to get the idea that I could talk to my mother about her life. Shock horror, who would have thought? But what happened then was that I actually found a very different mother. I found her. She shared a lot of stuff that she probably may not have shared 10 years earlier, I don't know. But I learned heaps about her. I learned heaps about my father, about their choices, and the ups and downs, particularly the downs, because they had a pretty tumultuous time in Ceylon towards the end, and then when they made the break, it was a big, big risk what they did. And it's like anyone who moves, but they were moving to different countries, different cultures.
Something about parents protecting their kids from the harm and hurt that they're feeling.
Yeah.
Which is a bit of a double-edged sword, isn't it? Because on the one hand, you're helping to shield your children and provide a safety net, but in another way, you become less known to your children in some ways.
And then that's as magical as it gets. I mean, my parents have contributed a lot towards my writing in these last few years, because I've been writing about family history and my memories and talking to my brother, who knows a lot more about that particular era than I do, talking about family history and what they went through. And a number of the people that I would want to talk to are dead. As we get older, we lose count of those people who can tell the stories. So I'm well aware of the fact that the stories I want to tell about my life, I want left behind so that anyone who's interested, like my daughters might be, have access. And I would not have thought of that 5 years ago. So that's really intriguing. This is the stuff that interests me. My father died when I was 20. He died when he was 61. My brother and I both outlived him. And my mother was 97 when she died. So there's a whole lot of issue there around genetics, but also around expectations of how long we're going to live, when's the other shoe going to fall, and all that stuff. I mean, I actually was aware of the fact that I was approaching my father's age when he died. Then I reached it, and then I passed it. And that was significant. Mm. I don't know if my brother felt the same, but I certainly did. And jokingly saying to people, I hope I've got my mother's genes, you know, because she lived forever. But I don't want to live forever if it's a pointless exercise and I'm sick. So that's another story. We won't go there just yet.
Yeah, yeah.
He lived long enough for me to start to get a sense of him as an adult and actually start to like him again, because I didn't like him for a long time, and then miss him, because he died just as I thought things were beginning to work out. And so that's what I've been doing ever since, is writing about him and finding out about him and writing in his voice, which is a strange thing to do, but has been actually quite effective. And my brother has said to me something, he said something to me not that long ago, when he said, Mum and I used to look at each other and basically gesture at me as if to say, look, see, because they were seeing Dad in me.
Right.
And I never knew that. And I'm glad he told me when he did, because if he told me some time before, I would have been really angry. Because the last thing I wanted to do was be like my dad. Now it's a badge of honour.
Yeah.
And it was actually quite nice, because I think, yes, all right, I'm happy with that. So we change. I'm not going to say we mature, but we change as we get older. Yeah, and I think this comes back to something you asked me earlier about my career, and my interpretation was, you were asking me whether as a child I was focused on anything in particular, except playing cricket. No, I wasn't. But now, whether or not I want to live to be 100 or I'm going to die tomorrow, I'm just well aware that in some of the stuff I've written that I've looked back at my life and said, am I happy with what I've done? And the answer is overwhelmingly yes. So it's okay already. I mean, and that's not to say everything's perfect, because it's not. But it's been interesting. We'll see what happens. Why I'm enjoying the work that I'm doing with caring, because most of the caring work I'm doing is with older men, not women. There are some women, but mostly men. What's been interesting about that is that I've find it easy to see them as role models for myself, because I think these are men who have lived a life of some significance to them and to their families, and in one case to no family at all, he's by himself. These are people who have lived a life, and they are relying on the people who give them care to be to treat them with safety and care and justice and respect, dignity. And I thought, well, this is how, when I reach that age, if I do, and I'm in a similar position, I hope to God I've got somebody who's going to give me that sort of care, because otherwise life sucks.
Mm.
The ending of it sucks.
Well, it's an interesting thing with the caring too, isn't it? Because for so much of our life, you can be very independent, and being cared for could be quite challenging, really.
Yeah, and I don't want to use this as a soapbox for anything to do with end of life, but it is a significant issue that we have to make choices, and I'm well aware of the fact that some of the conversations the people I'm caring for actually bring up, it's very real for them. They're thinking about what's going to happen next, and they're quite comfortable with it, most of them. They're not stressing. I mean, when you're a 93-year-old man who's worked as a significant professional in Perth for a long time, What's the fear?
Hmm.
So I think, well, geez, that's a bloody good role model.
And that's probably one of the things that changes as you get older, that, you know, the fear of death probably reduces.
I'm not sure about that either. I mean, I haven't got to the point where I'm actually that close to dying myself that I start to actually significantly think about it. But I am aware of the fact that I will. I mean, there was probably a longish period when it wasn't in my mind at all. Then a period where, earlier than that, when I thought I was immortal, like a lot of young people do. But I know full well it's going to happen. And I'm already aware of the signs of ageing. And not particularly fast. I know it's going to happen, and I'm doing my best to stave it off.
What about the physical side of ageing? Is that something that...
I'm someone who spent a lot of their youth... I spent a lot of my youth involved in sport, and I was naturally quite fit, and those days are long gone. I mean, I can still walk and ride a bike or whatever, but I don't look the way I used to look. I can't do what I used to do, but I do other things much better, and not physically and otherwise. I mean, I'm well aware of how to think differently, be patient, particularly being patient. I'm well aware of the fact that I've got a storage of life, history, energy to last me, well, to last me my lifetime. And it's all good. It's all good. I wrote something about looking back, am I happy to be where I am? And yes, I am. And why do I think I've had a good life? Well, because I've got no regrets. And that really surprised me, because I hadn't given it any thought consciously. But when I did, I started looking back and I thought, are all my relationships perfect? No, they're not. How's my health? My health is okay. Am I wealthy? Well, sort of marginally okay. None of those things are sort of in the big ticket box. And I think it probably emphasises how little they matter.
So what is most important, do you think?
Being engaged. Like when I actually finished my forced feeding of work, you know, going into an office every day for 20 years, 30 years, 40 years, whatever, when that stopped, that leaves a vacuum. And so I was doing other things, and then now my routine is I've got people I care for that I see 3 or 4 times a week. So in most days I'm doing something related to work. And I spent the rest of my time messing around in the garden, going for long walks in Fremantle, contacting friends, especially my brother and a couple of friends in Sydney and Melbourne who I've known for a long time, writing.
You're involved in groups too?
Lots of groups, and you mentioned community earlier. If I didn't have the groups, I would have to find them. I'm part of a community choir, which is wonderful. I'm part of a writers group, as I said, and that's been now for 3 or 4 years. I'm also involved in other sort of social groups, which are really interesting, with some fascinating people. So they're all things that are worth waking up for.
I don't know whether you need to make a separation between work and activity, except I guess work you get paid for, but whatever you do, if you're fully engaged and in the moment, and that's a kind of quite a satisfying state to be in, and
yes.
Find more that you can have that kind of experience in a way, the better, I guess.
Yes, it is, and having the capacity to experience that and to call it something, like, as you said, mentioned flow, there are I love books, I love reading, but I also love the stuff that I've been reading in the last 10 years, maybe, where it's to do with social change and sustainability and environmental issues and all those things. And watching and working with people who are passionate about those areas, I've learnt a lot. And that's why all the groups that I'm involved in at the moment give me balance, because the singing one is just pure joy, just energy. The Active Hope group that I'm part of is actually what it sounds like. It's actually looking for causes to be actively hopeful about the future. And the writers group, of course, I'm surrounded by people who are all writing about different things. And every time we meet, we share stuff and I learn something new. You know, it's just brilliant.
Talk a little bit about the Active Hope group. What's that?
Okay, Joanna Macy is the person who's written about Active Hope. And my very simplistic interpretation of it is that active hope is not sort of mindless optimism. It's actually looking at the issues of importance to you and to the world, and there is a focus mostly with active hope on looking at the state of the world.
Right.
I've actually made it, my focus is, yes, that's true, but I'm also more interested in how people deal with issues like this. So we're actively hoping. What that means is that I've got to do this justice. it's saying, this is something I want to achieve. I would love to achieve a much better climate change approach for Australia. It is almost impossible to imagine how I could do that by myself. If I allowed that to stop me, that would be self-defeating. Mm. So what I do is, as I say, what I hope for is this, and I'm going to do what I can to progress that. So that's my hope. My hope is that that will happen. I know I can't do it by myself, but I'm going to work towards it. And it's actually really interesting, because she talks about a model which actually makes a lot of sense to me. There's the business as usual model, which is what everyone does. Business as usual is what we see when we look out. And business as usual just means that you can very simply put your head in the sand because that's what you always do. If you step up and look over the parapet and start imagining something different and then work out ways that it might be achieved, that's active hope.
Right.
Rather than saying, I'm just one person, what can I do? It's pointless, which I've done. I mean, I'm quite comfortable doing that because it's an easy way out. But now I'm with a group of people who all think this is important, acting for the future of the world. So it must mean something to them, so it starts to mean something to me in a different way.
And working as a group, yeah. You also become supportive of one another, yes, in that,
yeah,
endeavour.
Yeah.
But I think also the fact of talking about something then enables other people to think about that and,
yes,
to use their own creativity and intelligence in coming up with solutions. So it can be a bit like a coin dropped in water and the spreading ripples, can't it? You know,
it can, and I think... Again, I'm being very simplistic about this because if people want to know more about Active Hope, they can look at the book, and there are lots of groups around now. But to me, it is, when do I actually decide that something is worth pursuing? It's only the only person who can decide that is me. And if I do decide to do it, do I want to do it by myself, which is quite hard, or do I want to do it in a company with people who are all focused in the same direction, which is better? And I've been lucky enough to fall into a group that does that. And I'm learning heaps. And I can actually see value in what we're doing.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't have been able to do it by myself.
And each person that joins that group adds something of their energy to the group and their,
yeah,
support.
Yep.
And that all helps too, you know, that's all important. So these are things in a way that once you retire, you don't have that pressure of working full-time to support a family or whatever you need to have that lot of, you know, that commitment to full-time work. Then it frees you up to actually be able to look at the bigger picture in some ways and to take a broader view. And
yes, I think it actually frees me up to realise that I've got no alternative but to look at the bigger picture because I can't put it off any longer. It's easy to say, look, work, you know, I've got too much on, I'd love to do that, but now I've got the time, so I've got no excuse. and I'm also, I mean, I am enthused by other people and I love the fact that I have all these groups, including the choir, because it gets me out. It gets me meeting people, seeing them regularly, becoming friends with them, having things to share. That's all important to me.
Something very satisfying also about making some sort of contribution.
Yes, yeah.
In that
and
way.
A different sort of contribution.
Yeah.
Yeah. And with, as a sort of link to something I was talking about before, I would love to have seen my father getting through life, finishing his medical work, becoming retired, doing the things he wanted to do, because he was going to be, he's a very smart writer, very good artist as well, and he would have been doing things in that field. Of course, he died before he could. And the argument was that you're a doctor, that's important work, writing isn't. So you don't do that until you've retired. And that was a message I'd heard loud and clear, and I've been struggling with ever since. That you don't do that stuff until when exactly?
Mm.
So I've been able to break that to an extent.
Hard to break, isn't it? To actually take the time for yourself to sit and do that can feel quite self-indulgent in a way. I'm talking as I'm talking about myself now, but
yeah. And you see, that's the thing that I don't know that it's self-indulgent. I think it's self-expressive, and it's something that we as a community are not necessarily encouraged to do.
Mm.
My mother was just an amazingly talented musician, and that's what she did. My father was, according to his school principal, who was close to all the end-of-year school leavers, you know, the Year 12 leavers, back when Dad was young, he had been able to remember all their names when he came back to visit them 50 years later.
Wow.
He also remembered them for what they were good at, and he was able to pick, with one exception, what they had done with their lives. He went up to Dad and he said, ah, yes, you're a journalist or you run a newspaper. And Dad said, no, I'm a doctor. he was blown away because he would never have seen that in a million years, because what he saw Dad doing was in letters, and in writing. So he would have done it, but it's a shame he never had the chance.
You get one shot at it. And
he made a good fist of it. I mean, yes. he was a fine doctor.
I'm sure he saved lives and, you know,
And he had something special as a career. But the but is not a major but. But he was a young man. He was 61.
Yeah.
So, I mean, relatively that's
too young to go. Going back to what you were saying about not having any regrets, that sometimes the little detours create the life that you have, and that can be better and richer than something that you might have imagined you might have.
Or... Well, yes. Yes to all that. Yeah, I agree. I think that I'm more coherent as a person. I think the bits are not as scattered, if that makes sense. I think there was a lot that sort of was just sort of thrown higgledy-piggledy, and not it's to do with not really having a clear focus on anything, just living. I think I've actually been able to pull some of the threads together far more as I've aged, and I've seen themes that I wanted to progress. And there's probably a heap of stuff that I wish if I had another 200-300 years, I might get to. So I tend to start a lot of stuff. And this is something I did write. I start a lot of stuff, and I've been accused, often I accuse myself, of not finishing. But it is interesting the things I have finished. Because I went back and I thought, surely I finished stuff, and of course I have.
Mm.
And I went back and started itemising the things I've finished. So I proved I can finish. What I think is an unfortunate discovery is that some of the things that I haven't finished are much more personal. Like writing. Writing for me is something that I really always wanted to do. Still do, and am still doing. But the end result of a writing thing is to have something completed and hopefully published, or at least completed. And that has been an area where I've struggled the most. And doing a bit of amateur psychology on that is probably because it's much more personal and much more important. But I have finished significant things in the past, so I have it in me to finish stuff. It's just...
Sometimes
to the right things.
No, I guess it's a very neat thing to start something, to do it, to finish it. But the process is really important in itself, and is a kind of an end in itself. You know, it's an interesting thing, this thing about... And I suppose this comes back to the idea of having goals as well and having a focus and all of this, is that maybe it's a Western form of thinking too, of having a particular goal and a particular end point that you have to get to, or...
There's a lot in there. We could spend another 5 hours on this. I'm aware of the fact that... Do I want to complete something on family history? Yes, I mean, yes, that was my original plan. I've got about 200 pages worth of stuff on family history already done, but it's spread across several different people and several different storylines, but it's done. It's there. So if anyone is interested, they can't go and buy the book off the shelf, but it's in my computer and it's backed up, which is important. And I discovered last night, I was thinking about the field I'm in, which is looking at the third age, looking at us as a group as we age, as baby boomers age, how we do that and how well we do that. I realised that I've been writing about this for the last 5 years, and I thought, shivers. God, I have. So I started this morning, I started going through, looking through my historical stuff, and I've got reams of it. Doesn't mean it's any good. But I've got a lot of stuff which I hadn't actually realised, if you want to give it a heading, is about that topic. And I can package that.
That's right. Well, that part of it is about packaging too, and the whole idea of whether something's good or not. I think sometimes there's a idea of it can get in the way of having things finished too, you know. I remember going to a writing workshop, and the chap there said he never gets writer's block because he has very low standards. Which I thought was great, because, you know, in a way, you do have to just get out of your own way and write.
And stuff that appears on the page in front of you might surprise you, it might horrify you.
Yes, that's right.
This is what you'll be editing this, I know. Whatever you're doing with this, this has actually been... We've covered a lot of territory. But what's been interesting to me is that the validity of a process like this is hearing yourself talk about stuff which is important to you, because every time you talk about it, you hear something different. And that's what I'm finding with my clients. The more I talk to them, and they tend to take often the same tack, talk about the same thing. But if you remember what they said last time and feed that back to them, they give you something different, often.
Yep.
Because they're sparked by what you've told them, which they recognise, and often that makes a small connection which allows them to then expand on the story. And I was amazed when I heard that the first time. It doesn't always happen. But it's like Groundhog Day, you know, the movie with Bill Murray.
Yes, yeah.
Where he wakes up every morning to the same day. But if you wake up every morning to the same day and do what he does, which is actually come in with pre-knowledge, things change.
That's right. And that's how recovery of memory works too. Each time you recover a memory, it's changed in some way.
But it's wonderful to actually see it work.
Yeah. I think the other thing about telling a story, right, whether you write it down or you speak it, is as you write, which you have already alluded to, or as you speak, you form your ideas in that way.
Yes.
What's really odd about the social media that's around these days is that it kind of is there in the public view, and it becomes almost like a historical document that stays there, so that as you change as a person, it's almost like you're stuck in that earlier version of you, of what you thought and what you said, whereas, you know, that's a thing of living a certain number of years, that you do change as you go on, even though you might perceive yourself as the same person, but your ideas have grown and changed and all of that kind of thing.
And people hold you to the old model, which is, if they want to, they will.
That's right.
They'll go back and say, but you said...
Yeah, well, that happens with politicians, doesn't it? Yeah. And it's very unforgiving, and in a way it's kind of like, well, you know, you'd have to worry about a person who didn't change their views, who didn't, with new evidence.
Maybe it's telling us something different about the process of remembering stuff as well, that instead of saying, no, I never said that, say, yeah, I did. That's what I thought at the time. I don't think that now.
Mm.
Maybe that diffuses the issue. I don't know. Maybe people have to learn different ways of handling all that sort of feedback.
Yeah.
Instead of saying, no, I never said that. I never said that.
Another thing I just wondered whether you might comment on too is how there seems to be a lot of commentary about baby boomers and being very entitled and very privileged and the lucky generation, you know, and all of this kind of thing, which... there may be elements of truth within that, although I would think that, you know, it's a very big group of people. It's probably goes across a couple of generations, actually, because it's, I think, baby boomers, I think it was from the end of the Second World War to about 1964 that the actual baby boom happened.
Which is a huge period.
Which is,
turmoil.
Yeah, kind of 20 years of... You know, there's so many different people within that, with different circumstances and things, but you're perceived as you get older as being less flexible, less able to cope with new technology, all of these things. And yet it's not something that I've actually witnessed amongst my peers that find people are fairly flexible and fairly on top of the technology and all of that kind of thing.
I'm not sure if this is where you're heading, but one thing that's clear to me is that we, as baby boomers, whether we like it or not, have been involved in every significant cultural change of the last 20 years. And in fact, we're driving aging. We're driving healthcare, because we are the large group of people. As we move through society, it's just bad luck for the generations behind us. But we're having to deal with these issues. I mean, we're the ones who have to live, for the first time, we have to live a lot longer on our savings, because the government's not going to do it.
Mm.
We're the first group that has to do that. And we're not dying at 70. We're dying at 80 or 90.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to find money to do that, or somewhere to live, or whatever.
Yeah.
And so that's one significant thing that we're doing. Because we've created a lot of it, but we're having to deal with it as well.
What would you see as ageing badly?
whinging a lot, I think, is aging badly. I think anyone who sees entitlement as something that's important, you know, I'm entitled to this, I've paid my dues, I've paid my taxes, I want this. Well, sometimes it doesn't work like that. I think aging badly is perhaps something to do with knowing what you can be doing and not bothering, and therefore becoming a burden on society because you're overweight and unhealthy. But ultimately, the person who suffers is you. And other people around you who are close to you suffer because you've been smoking or you're overweight and you've been drinking too much or whatever. So aging badly, I think, is shutting down and thinking you're old. I think that's the worst thing. I would find it very easy to just settle back and be old. I think there have been periods in my life where I have actually been old, even though I have been young in years, because I've shut down and I've sort of been drifting. And I think that's the thing I have to fight to avoid, just drifting.
So old can be like a state of mind as much as anything else?
Yeah, I'm probably over-dramatising it, but I'm well aware of the fact that it would be very easy to... Vegging out is okay. Vegging out is fine, so long as you have a purpose around the vegging out. Whereas I have been fully employed, have had a family and have been old, because I have just shut down and I've just been drifting. Day by day, everything's the same. Things now are different to that because there's a lot more... I'm not sure what's going to happen today with this client, or I'm not sure if I'm even going to see this client today. And that happens because clients die or they get moved to a nursing home or whatever.
That would be quite confronting in a way, the sort of work you're doing where people coming face-to-face, in a sense, with mortality on a regular basis because of the type of work that you do.
Yeah, and that's surprisingly... I'm not going to say easy to do, but it's surprisingly okay. I'm also aware of the fact that I'm getting a much broader palette to reflect on, that I'm seeing the families. I'm seeing the way different families deal with dementia and ageing and the loss of the person they know, even though the person's still there physically. The fact that the person they used to know and rely on is completely missing.
Yeah. Is
scary. And they don't necessarily deal with it well. And as a carer, it's easier for me to come in and deal with it in a more level-headed way because there isn't the emotional hook.
Mm.
But I've seen some things with families where they just fallen apart because it's too hard. And then they get really angry and cranky and quite destructive. Since I actually pulled the pin on my full-time employment, I think I have grown heaps as a person, large part due to the fact that a lot of the time I had no idea what I was doing because I was into new things. It's been the most productive, it's been the most varied, most engaging, and I've learnt, my relationships have improved dramatically across the board. Not always to the better, but they've changed dramatically. And how's that happened? I can see a parallel with the way my relationship with my mother grew, because whatever it was, I started to actually ask her questions about her life, and I expressed interest in her and spent heaps of time with her, for which I'm immensely grateful. I learned a lot from that, and I think it's because I've actually been... my curiosity has been rewarded much more. I'm a naturally fairly curious person, but a lot of the time it was just... I was fairly stodgy and sort of heavy with it. Not so much anymore.
So curiosity is a really big part of maintaining that.
And all jokes aside, for the finishing stuff, curiosity and follow-through are essentially important. So I'm actually contributing to these groups I mentioned earlier, and I'm contributing in a way which means that people are happy to see me and I'm happy to be there. And we are getting things done. And whether or not I finish them, it doesn't matter, because there's stuff being progressed, which is...
Because you're part of a group, and because the group has a continued life, hopefully.
Yes, yeah. And so all those things, they're not finite. I mean, at some point the groups will stop doing what they do, but while they're doing what they're doing, it's fascinating being part of it.
Mm.
And I just love the fact that I'm still able to be fascinated.
Yeah.
And engaged. Why shouldn't we be fascinated and engaged? Just because we've reached a certain number.
That's probably the crux of what keeps you living and keeps life worth living and keeps you interested in things, yeah. You know.
I'm probably unlikely to play cricket for Australia.
Damn.
Yeah. I missed by that much. And, I mean, all those things, all those physical things, they're not going to happen because my body won't be able to take it.
There's always a Masters.
Yes, there is. And we have lots of examples of that in our family as well. But is my body doing what I need it to do? Yes. And as long as that continues, all is good.
That's right. And just to be grateful for being able to do that.
Yeah.
So, great.
And not to take it for granted.
I'd like to thank Martin for his wonderful contribution to this episode. I feel that this episode demonstrates the opportunities to explore and contribute to society in a range of different ways once the heavy financial obligations of raising a family and saving for the future become less pressing. New work that provides a different perspective on life and enables one to engage in fresh ways becomes possible with the increased flexibility that is often afforded in this stage of life. Creative pursuits and dreams can be realised. This time in life also brings with it a clearer understanding that life and health are not a given, and that it is important to both seize the day and enjoy the day. And once again, thank you for listening.